Yes, you, listener. Did you know that everybody at History Hack works for free? And as much fun as that is, it would be great if we could garner just a little bit of support for all of the time and effort that goes into producing the show. I have a cat that needs food. Zach has Airfix models to buy. And Boney, well, Boney likes books. So if you can chuck us a couple of quid as a one-off via Ko-fi or subscribe to Patreon, we would much appreciate it. Thank you.
Hello, welcome to History Hack. I am back, ladies and gentlemen. I am back, and I've got with me the fabulous Beth. Beth, tell us who've we got on today.
Oh, it is wonderful to have you back, Alina, after all this time. So, and I'm really looking forward to this one. I think this will be a good first one back for you. So we're joined by Lindsay Powell today. Lindsay is an ancient historian with a passion for the military might of Rome. And obviously I find Rome really quite interesting myself. I'm not sure about anyone else, but I love it. He's authored numerous books, edited magazines, and you will see his face on your TV in some places as well. And today he's here to tell us about the subject of his new book, The Jew Who Defied Hadrian and Challenged the Might of Rome. So, Lindsay, welcome to History
Thank
Hack.
you. Thank you very much indeed. It's excited to be here.
Bar Kokhba is not the name of the person that it's associated with, is it?
That's interesting. That was one of the things that I picked up in all the research. Yes, it's basically the name of an avatar, if you like, and it has a sort of religious connotation. So we can explore some of those things. But what we understand is if you look at the pile of evidence that we've got, it takes the form of coins. So the rebels that he led took Roman coins and overstamped them with their own messages and pictures. So they were literally defacing the Roman emperor's face by smashing their own images of lyres and grapes and stuff on top of his face. And the inscriptions, which were written in a very old form of Hebrew called Paleo-Hebrew, call him Shimon. That's all they call him, Shimon. And then when you read the later texts, what you'll find is that they then start using this word, which was really Kuziba, which is Ben Kuziba. And that actually means, believe it or not, son of a lie. And what's interesting, when you start following all the threads, it turns out that the evidence, the archaeological evidence, shows us that his actual name was Shimon Ben Kosiba, which is Kosiba is just the father's name or the name of a place. But because in Hebrew you can change letters, that changes the meaning. So an innocent name meaning son of Kosiba, by changing one name by meaning it Bar Kosiba, means it went from Kosiba to a liar. Why is that all significant? You're probably losing your attention by now. It's important because in the interpretations that happened in his lifetime, but mostly afterwards, a particular rabbi who's very important in the great story of Judaism made a link between the man that he was seeing in life, we think, and this prophecy of a messiah coming along. And there's this idea of a star, which as it turns out is Kukba in Hebrew. And he said, this man is the son of the star of prophecy, which means he's the messiah. So what happens is that the Christian writers, and this is interesting, most people don't understand this, actually, we think of Roman history, we think of Jewish history, maybe not so much, but there's a Christian history as well. And there were contemporaries of this man, people like Justin Martyr, who started to use words describing like Bar Kochebas, right? So what they seem to be hearing is that they're hearing these Hebrew names and they're transliterating them into Greek. So ironically, he calls himself Shimon. That's what he calls him. His name is Shimon Kosba by virtue of the letters that we found. But other people, either contemporary or later, refer to him as Bar Kokhba, which seems to mean son of a star. So this rather strange misnaming is part of the legend, which is developed over later and later years. And in the way that King Arthur's story may have a root of truth in it, which is maybe he's a leader of a resistance fighter in a part of Britain. We don't quite know where that is. People still fight over that. Is it Wales? Is it Cumbria? Where? This man we know exactly did exist. We know he had a name. We know that he did things, which were things that rebels do. But later people reinvented him for their own purposes. And as we talk about the history of Israel and places in later ages, it's how people use people of the past to further their own designs and interests, which is really interesting to me because it's in a sense it's how you make history. And I think when you do podcasts about history. And I think that what we try to get to is this idea that there's a truthiness to it. There's a truth, right? But as you find out, when you read historical accounts, you always have to be aware of the writer has an agenda. He's trying to make a point. He's bringing out certain things, but he's leaving out other things. And we've got to be, I think, very aware when we read historical documents and then look at archaeology and all the other stuff. And by the way, being there to test it all out yourself, that you try to get as close to the reality of the historical character as you can. And that's for me, that's great appeal. That's great draw.
I'm going to throw in another character that comes into your story, and that's Hadrian. And a lot of the Brits out there are going to know about Hadrian's Wall. And I think a lot of us know that's pretty much what we know about Hadrian, is about Hadrian's Wall. I mean, can you tell us a little bit about who Hadrian was? Where are we in history with him, and what is he like?
Oh, that's a wonderful question. And he's really one of history's most interesting, beguiling, and frustrating characters. Yes, he commissioned a wall, which, by the way, he never saw completed, which is kind of ironic. And that's also typical of so many things that he did. He was a great itinerant Roman emperor. He traveled a lot. And the result is he started things. He poured money into projects, build a temple, build a city, you know, do these things. But he never actually got back to see how the progress was made on things. So it's ironic that, yes, in his lifetime, we're talking, because he asked what period we're talking about. He was born in 76 AD. So if you refer to sort of biblical history, if you're interested in those things, this is about 50 or 60 years after the death of Christ, right? So this is after Augustus, this is after Caligula. We're into the, I think, the 9th or 10th or 11th emperor at this point. So Hadrian is a fascinating character because he's only the, if you like, the second potentially non-Roman, let's just say Italian emperor that Romans have. There's some argument whether he was actually born in Spain or whether he was born in Rome. I think he was born in Rome. But his history is fascinating because, one, he's the great traveler. There's one of the Roman writers describes him as a man of great curiosity and exploration. I think he'd have been a very good historian because he was restless. He wanted to travel. He wanted to find out stuff. He was a military guy. He was a Hellene in the sense that if it was Greek, he loved it. He was gay, we think, which is interesting because that's a great subject for historians, because now we're opening the doors on gay history. And only in the last 6 or 7 years, there's gradually now a sort of an opening up of the mind to say that, yes, we actually have here a gay Roman emperor, which is quite fascinating, who has a boyfriend, by the way, who takes him on tours. And we know that he's a man that's got a great curiosity about the world, but he also has an underpinning of cynicism. He's skeptical about things. He has a cold side to his character where he can be very dismissive of people, make them feel very uneasy, and expect them to commit suicide, sort of thing. So is he the kind of guy that you want to have a beer with in a pub? In fact, I actually wrote a paragraph to go in the book, and I decided not to include it. And it basically concluded this. This is sort of guy that you'd want to have on your quiz team in the pub, because he'd probably know all the answers, and he'd always want to have the last word, and he'd probably sort of make some sharp comments, and you'd go with this chill would descend down your backbone, because you realize there's a story where apparently he was arguing with somebody about the meaning of a word. And these people said, well, how would you know? And he said, you're really going to argue with a guy who's got 30 legions? I won't argue with him.
Well, obviously, we've got the two main characters of your book, as it were. But obviously, what the essence of the book is, it's about the plot, isn't it? What happens in Israel in this time period. And obviously you can't not talk about, if you're talking about Israel, you have to talk about the Jewish people who are in Israel at the time. So who are the kind of people that are in Israel at that time? Are they, because we have this, I mean, from the limited information I have about that area of the world at that time is that, you know, they're a repressed people. The Romans are definitely in charge. Is that the case?
I think, you know, taking the 36,000 feet view, that's probably true. To put it in context, so the Jews and the Romans have a very awkward relationship in this regard. So the Romans didn't set out to conquer this part of the world, which is actually called Judea in most historical accounts. And by accident, partly, they fall into occupying this place. Jewish history goes back thousands of years. And it's a fascinating topic all on its own. But in essence, the Jews consider themselves the chosen people. They have one God. They have covenant with the God. They have to circumcise if you're male. There are dietary requirements. There are observational things you have to do with religious practice. There are books. You have to study Talmud and Torah. And so the books relate to Moses. And those insights govern how people rule their lives. And what's fascinating about that is Romans sort of kind of get the idea that it's very old, and they respect because it's very old. They also understand that they've got these books and documents and okay, that kind of go. But what they wrestle with is the fact that they just kind of won't conform. And that Romans expect, and this is from the sort of the administration point of view, maybe more so than the ordinary man in the street, that part of the fact of actually being a person within the Roman world is this the flexibility to be able to tolerate other people. So you'll expect that they have different religions, and that's not usually the point that people argue about. But they will say, look, in order for us to get along, we have certain feast days and sort of festivals and sacrifices, and we expect you to show up because that's what Romans do. Today we're going to sacrifice to Minerva or to Mars, you know, show up. And the Jews will say, I'm sorry, I can't because that's Shabbat. You know, I have to. And they'll say, what do you mean you can't be there? Everybody's going to be there. Well, we can't because our religious things tell us not to. And it's little sort of details like that, misunderstandings that cause friction. In the time of that we're talking about, there had been already in the 50 years previously a disastrous revolt where the Jews rallied around a couple of individuals. And basically the intention was to set up an independent state to boot the Romans out. And the Romans were caught kind of unawares, and this is at the time of Nero, interestingly enough, in 68. And Nero sends in his best generals, a guy, one of those is Vespasian, who's actually got a number of campaigns behind him, some of which are in Britain, interestingly enough, as a younger commander. And that revolt, which starts in 66 AD, ends up with the destruction of the temple in 70. Why is that important? Well, the focus of Judaic tradition and religious observation is the temple in the center, in the heart of Jerusalem at this time. And the first one had been built by Solomon, that had been destroyed by the Babylonians, it had been rebuilt. By the time the Romans saw it in 70, it had been rebuilt again by Herod. A lot of Jerusalem had been rebuilt by Herod, and Herod was considered by the Romans to be a very good ambassador for them. He kind of tolerated, he worked with them. He was very much a sort of philo-Roman in the sense that he adopted the ways and means and all the rest of it that went along, and was a very good man to have on the spot. But there were tensions because a lot of Jews said, well, actually, you're a Jew in name only, a gyno, if you like. And that itself caused problems. And when he died in about 4 BC, the Romans started to get more involved and meddle. And the trouble is between 4 BC and 66, there are all these opportunities for people to riot and cause areas of disaffection and so on. There are a number of people who stand up as figures that call themselves effectively messiahs. And this is another aspect which kind of is tricky because within the Jewish tradition, there's an idea that the people who have been sort of spread across the world, I mean, a lot of Jews, of course, you remember ended up in Babylonia, by the rivers of Babylon, famous the Psalm. The idea is that they will come back together, but they will come back together because a man will lead them, a guy called a Moshiach, a messiah. But he's a military figure, effectively. I mean, it's about fire and brimstone and sort of throwing out the enemies from Jerusalem, taking back the 12 tribes and really reestablishing covenant with God. This is the kind of thing that happens. But in actuality, all of these fail. All these failed messiahs that come and go. And the Romans just think of them as being a thorn in the side. And administrators go in, famously Pontius Pilate, remember him? Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Who is faced with another guy who's presented as a messiah. And he goes, not another one, you know. And this ultimately leads to the Romans besieging Jerusalem. They destroy the temple with profound impact, because the whole of the idea of Judaism was centered really about rituals around the temple. When you take the temple away, you can't have the rituals. So the Pharisees and the Sadducees, all those people we kind of read about in the New Testament context, they effectively kind of disappear. So in the world that we come up to when Hadrian's coming in And this man that we're going to be talking about, Balkhakwa, he exists in the world where those people don't exist. There is no temple culture anymore. Judaism is at risk, in effect, of going in many, many different directions. And this little group of people, there are only about 60 of them, apparently, in Judea at this time, who are called rabbis, which basically means my teacher. And that these people fill the vacuum left by the Sadducees and the Pharisees. And they are the people who will now interpret the five books of Moses and try and say, so when, for example, a Jew says, I don't understand, I want to marry this woman, you know, what do I need to do to make sure that the rituals and the cleanliness and so on? And you would go to the temple previously and you would talk to somebody, even though, you know, have a paschal lamb and a lamb, you'd have the sacrifice, you'd get the words and off you go, oive. But this didn't happen. So now rabbis were the people who gradually became much more important figures in Jewish society. And we come then ultimately to this guy called Rabbi Akiba. And he is the one who makes this association between this man, Ben Kozibar, and this messianic figure, and says he is the guy that's going to boot out the Romans. He is the guy we can rally around, and he's the guy that my money's on. And this is a figure that goes right the way through Jewish history. Rabbi Akiba becomes a very, very important figure. And it's a very complicated thing to try and convey, but to bring it down to brass tacks, the Romans don't understand this. Okay, you can see the potential for misunderstandings, that there's a language difference as well. I mean, the Jews, of course, they're speaking Hebrew. I don't know that there's many Romans are speaking Hebrew. And actually in that part of the world, many people are Greek speakers. So you've already got this triangulation of three aspects. So in this small strip of land in Judea, you've got Jews who are really unhappy because in the previous 50 years, they'd seen their temple destroyed, and there's a lot of really terrible consequences from that. The Romans start to double down on their military occupations. There are the troubles that go on with the other pagan communities who once again sort of see that the Jews are kind of the downtrodden ones at this, and start to really rub that in. Hadrian comes into this, bumbles into it, I'm not sure, because I always look at this man and think that he's really smart. He understands stuff. He asks questions. He can have anything he wants, and he normally gets anything he wants. And on his tours of the world, he's fascinated. He sees cities with potential. Hey, you could build a new forum there. I'll give you some money. Go build a forum. Look, you need a wall. Build a wall between that place and that place. Do it. And he's doing this. And he has a plan for Jerusalem. So after this war that destroyed the temple in 70, basically Jerusalem is a ruin. It's fascinating to think that the place that we see on TV on a regular basis, crammed, filled with buildings, flags flying, and all that, was a ruin. And it had been basically a ruin for almost 50 years. There was a Roman camp, we think, actually inside the actual walls of Jerusalem at that time to ensure that nothing really happened. There's some evidence for industrial activity and so on, and maybe some merchants. But Hadrian looks at this and says, this is magnificent as a site. If you've ever been to Jerusalem, the physical site itself is fascinating. It's actually very high up on a hill. We tend to think of Israel being very flat. And to the point where I was saying that the thrill of doing the research is to go to a place to really imbibe it and run the soil through your fingers. The soil in Israel, by the way, is a sort of like milky, creamy colored limestone. Melek limestone, and all the buildings therefore have this wonderful sort of milky whitish color about them, and Jerusalem is very high up, but there's snow in the winter a lot of the time. People don't think of that part of the world they ever have snow. It gets really hot and humid, but you get snow in the winter. And he looks at this place and says, I see great potential for this. Why don't we redesign it, build a new city? The trouble is that there's so much religious investment in that place for a pagan to come along and say, I'm going to redesign this and I'm going to give it a name called Colonia Aelia Capitolina, which basically is clever rebranding. Aelia is the name of his family. He is Aelius Hadrianus. And what he's doing in the name of the city, he's branding it. This is my city. It's a colonia, which is basically a city where Roman citizens, often former soldiers, retired soldiers, will set up home. And Capitolina is the final nail in the coffin, if you will, because the Capitolian name refers back to the Capitolium Hill in Rome itself, where there's temples to Jupiter, Juno, and Minerva, the sort of the three principal Roman gods. So in one fell swoop, He's going to redesign a Jewish city, put Roman citizens, all ex-soldiers in there, and he's actually scrubbed the name out as well by calling it basically my city and my gods. Mm. You can only imagine the sort of repulsion that you would have for something like that. The only thing I can suggest is, for example, if another group of people went in and demolished the Vatican and decided we're going to build a supermarket on the top of it. You know, that's the sort of shock value I think that this would have. And that would seem to be the trigger point for this rebellion. And people rallied around this man that we call Bar Kokhba to actually liberate and kick these Romans out.
Is it fair to say that Hadrian actually makes a systematic attack on Judaism?
Oh, that's really hard to answer. My impression from reading everything is no, I don't think so. Part of the issue is this, going back to what I said earlier, is the Romans have this really uncomfortable, somewhat uninformed relationship with their Jewish community members anyway. But they do sort of respect them to the extent that there are synagogues in Rome, for example. There's a big Jewish community in Rome. They're all over the Roman world. They're actually in the army. I mean, you know, so Jews have a very active part in the Roman world. I don't see really specifically at this time him going out of his way to pick on individual Jews or the whole culture and trying to eradicate it. Now, that there had been in the years after the Jewish war, and remember I told about that was 66 to 73, everybody's heard of Masada. So famously, Masada is basically the last thing that happens in this Jewish war. And certainly the Flavians, remember I mentioned the name Vespasian who took over Nero? So he actually becomes emperor, and he and his sons, particularly Titus, who was very active in that war, and then Domitian take over. They have a very aggressive anti-Semitic policy. They tax Jews particularly. There's a fiscus judicus, which basically is a treasury. And what they do is the tithe that Jews pay to support the temple in Jerusalem. Well, the way they look at it is, so war reparations, we're confiscating that money and we're going to use that to build our temples. So there are all sorts of the bad feelings that happen from that. But by the time you get to Hadrian, another emperor stepped in the way and has actually eliminated that tax. In fact, he issues a coin basically saying this was really bad, the bad public policy, and it was just bad for our empire. We're not going to do that anymore. There's an insinuation that he introduced some sort of legislation to ban circumcision. The problem with that is it's only mentioned in one document, and the document itself, a little bit dubious quality. It's called the Historia Augusta or Scriptoris Historia Augusta, which is like a 4th century AD compilation of biographies. And there's a lot of scholarly debate as to whether they're written by one man or several. Are they really satirical? I mean, that's an interesting thing. You know, we tend to think because they're written in Latin or Greek, they must be very serious. So the Romans actually writing a satirical biography, that's a little uneasy, isn't it? But on the other hand, we've got Suetonius. How about this for an interesting factoid? Suetonius is actually the record keeper for the Emperor Hadrian, right? And there's some insinuation that he sort of gets a bit too close to Hadrian's wife and is dismissed from his office. So ironically, we could have had a couple of extra chapters for the life of the Caesars. Remember, the 12 Caesars is the famous thing that's written. He could have written the one about Trajan and Hadrian, but we don't have that. So we have to rely on these other sources. And this one I'm talking about, which is the Historia Augusta, which you'll often see abbreviated to either SHA or simply HA, HAD dot, Hadrian being the HAD. And it's full of all these really interesting details, but you're always left with this question, is it really true? And that's part of the challenge in trying to understand the man and the events of a time. So that's the place that mentions circumcision. And it's an attack. If you certainly ban circumcision, this is the crux of the covenant between Jewish males and God, Yahweh. And if it's true, it's pretty badly judged. The other side of it is that actually the Jews weren't the only people in the ancient world to engage in circumcision. There were other Arabic communities as well. That the Romans looked at it as being, there's the Latin phrase actually translates as mutilation of the genitals. And in fact, under earlier emperors, it was tantamount to murder. I mean, it's a strange thing for us to think about that. But again, you're looking at different cultural appreciations of the human body. And the Greeks have a different view of it than the Romans. The Romans come to adopt more of a Greek view on the body. like they have no particular problems showing it off, right, in public nudity. Jewish people have a problem with that. I mean, it's not modest to do those sorts of things. On the other hand, a sort of circumcised male at a gymnasium is a subject of ridicule because, look, he has no foreskin. What sort of mutilation is this? So that's really all you can say, in addition then to which this decision to build Jerusalem, and there's some other things. There are insinuations that he's trying to ban Sabbath and studying Torah and these sorts of things. But again, it's the quality of the books you get information from. A lot of these books were written a long time afterwards, and there was a vested interest of those people writing the history to pin a lot of things on this because they were trying to give a slant and to make themselves even more the underdog, right? You have to sort of build this case of, you know, we've been picked on for all these years, and look what he did. So it's really hard to tell, but to sum this part up, I don't think he had a particularly anti-Semitic policy, but it was tantamount. If you were a Jew, that's how you might interpret it.
Yeah. So obviously the your story is about Bar Kokhba and what happens in that period of time. So let's get into that. So tell us about who Shimon ben Kosiba, however you say it. Who is he at this time? How does he come into the story? And how do we know about him?
You know, good questions. So let's just call him Shimon for the sake, because that's easier. Yeah. Shimon means Simon. We know who's Jewish. We have some letters which are actually in his name. We also have one which we believe actually has a signature on, which is really shocking because you can actually, it's rare that you can read a letter and see a signature at the end of it. I mean, this is one of the great appeals to me. Most other sort of ancient history, you have to read an inscription and you have to read Tacitus and something, and you're very, very distant from the events. But here we've got a rare case where he might have actually written that. So what we know from a combination of the Greek sources, which are primarily Cassius Dio, who's writing around about 220 AD, so already about 100 something years after the events. There are basically two chapters in one of his books which sets the scene and really amazingly doesn't describe him. so he doesn't mention him by name. So there's a revolt that happens, but they don't mention him by name. We know through the later Jewish kind of descriptions that he seems to have been a man from the south of the country, so probably more the desert area, more the sort of area that we would consider now to be occupied territories, actually. I mean, area around Hebron, for example, not as far west as Gaza, but Hebron and maybe slightly southeast of that. So that wonderful part of the country, which is the Judean Shephelah, which is the rolling hills and just a lovely part of the country. He spoke Hebrew. It's very interestingly, he seems in the letters to insisted that his scribes wrote in Aramaic book hand. So when you see Jewish documents today, you notice those beautiful square-like characters with lots of accents. Before that, there had been another style of writing, which we call Paleo-Hebrew, which was quite frankly, looks like a spider's crawled over the page. It's a very strange kind of way of looking at it, but very antique. It goes back many, many hundreds of years. And he decided that because the religious texts, the Torah mainly, were written in this style, that he wanted official correspondence to be written in this style. So what's really interesting is you get these documents where people are having to effectively learn how to write in this way and to speak Hebrew. So he's trying to unify the people around this idea of an identity of Jewishness, which is also reflected in the writing. But it also creates the idea that official correspondence looks almost religious, which is really interesting. I'm trying to think, in a sense, it's a bit like English literature suddenly being written in Gothic, like to imitate sort of like King James Bible or something. You know, it carries a weight and authority, therefore. So when he sends out from his headquarters, you know, I wanted to do this, written in this book hand, you go, oh, better do that because it's really official. We know he was a stickler for observing all the Jewish holidays and the letters go to great lengths to make sure that they get, for example, the citrons and palm fronds and stuff so they can observe the various festivals. We know from the same letters that he was a micromanager. He was somewhat of a disciplinarian. He was probably quite cruel. He didn't suffer fools lightly. And there are a number of instances where he's basically telling his troops, his lieutenants, if you like, or lieutenants, pull your finger out. I'm paying your salary. We're all sacrificing. You're not doing your job. Get it done. And it's really interesting to sort of get these perspectives, which are authentic, because this is his voice, either him directly or through his scribes. And there must have been a great charisma about this man. And those are the things in history you have to sort of like imply from reading things. The fact is, people followed him. Okay, the way I can describe it is, someone says, I've got an idea to take our country back. Got to be careful now. And, you know, people might laugh at you, but if you're a certain persona, if you have a certain way of speaking and a passion, maybe a lot of people will follow you. And he was that man. He does seem to have been able to achieve that, because Hadrian, who visits Judea in 130, it seems to be to inspect progress on his city, right? Because this is work that he's commissioned. He wants to see how it's going. And then he moves off and he goes then off to Egypt. And then he goes then on tours around the rest of the world. 2 years later, this revolt blows up and people are overstamping these coins with his name, Shimon. He is self-styling him. He gives himself the title Nazi, which seems to be like president or prince, probably more like a president or premier, which is interesting because, again, looking back through more recent Jewish history, that would seem to imply possibly a nationalistic idea that he is in charge of this campaign, this government. And by the way, the name he gives his government is Israel. So he calls himself President of Israel, Nazi Yisrael. Mm. And this is fascinating because what that means is he could have called the country Judea. He doesn't. He could have called it Zion or Zion as his. No, he chose Israel deliberately. And he has maybe aspirations not just to take back this part of the world where his people are, but to bring other people into his campaign. And at this point, now we have to sort of almost guess what his motives are. But it's very clear he has a title, he has a name, he's using rabbinic law to govern how people rule their lives, and he expects people to follow it. You know, when he gives an order, you follow the orders. And so I wonder, in a sense, that the cover of my book, interesting enough, I try to put two faces. The man in the background, by the way, is the Emperor Hadrian. The man in the front is an unknown man. That isn't Bar Kokhba. But I thought that I needed a face to put, because you, under Jewish traditions, you can't show a graven image, right? You can't actually make a carving of a man, because that would break the 10th commandment. But what I think what this is really two men who are very much alike. Micromanagers, strong individuals, think they know how to get it done, get really irritated by people who think they know better than him. And it's a clash between those two personalities. And what's extraordinary is that this man, who's in a teeny tiny little part of the world, and you remember because you've been to Israel, it's a very small place. It's like 35 miles wide, like 100 and something, 70 miles tall, right? I mean, this whole thing could sit in greater London almost, you know. It's a tiny little place. And yet he managed to pin down the Romans for 3.5 years. He had a functioning country for 3.5 years. How can this be? And this was a great mystery for me. And to some degree, I still haven't been able to answer it because there's so many unanswered questions. But it's a fascinating story.
So tell us, I mean, how he goes about it, because this is incredible. I mean, you just said it's difficult to answer. Give us a little bit of an insight.
The impression we get, we have to go back to Cassius Dio. He seems to sort of suggest that this was long term in the planning. He talks about that there were mutterings behind closed doors and in farms. So the one thing about this part of Israel is that there are not many big towns, but there are lots of fortified farms which are on hilltops and so on, and they grow wheat and grow vines and so on. But they also dig tunnels underneath their villages. Because that's where you keep cool stuff, right? That's what stuff you keep cool. But interesting enough, that's also where you can plan and scheme. And what it seems to be is that this man and people that he brought to his cause planned to have an uprising, that there must have been a scheme to arm people. Cassius Dio refers to the Jews making weapons for the Romans, but making them just low enough quality that the Romans would reject them, which means that they just take them back and say, very sorry, and they correct them and then they use them for themselves. So he builds up armaments that way. He sort of builds up a secret army, it would seem to be. And at some chosen time, we don't know when, around about AD 132, when Hadrian is far away, and the Romans are distracted, and bang, this thing happens. And the impression that we have is that the nexus of this was a place called Herodium, which is an absolutely magnificent human-made mound just east of Jerusalem. And it's actually fascinatingly built. It's like a conical hill that rises out of the Judean plain. And on the top of this, Herod had built a fortress, a circular fortress. It was actually a magnificent piece of architecture. And he also built his sepulchre actually in the side of it. And it had been a focal point of command under the first Jewish war. And then Titus had come along and basically bulldozed it. But there was enough left of it that this man that we're calling Shimon looked at it and thought, that will be my headquarters. And from there, that was his forward field headquarters that he commanded the other militias. And that seems to be all he had was militia army. It was people, one day they're farmers or bookkeepers, and next day they're picking up a sword and a spear and a shield, and now you're the army. and that's basically what they had. And with that, they were able to launch guerrilla attacks on the Romans, who, it turns out, from Cassius Dio, had no idea what was going on. It's extraordinary to think that we seem to think of them in a little bit, and I've got to be very careful how I phrase this, but I think a lot of people have the idea of an invincible Roman world, but the Romans are able to control absolutely everything. They are the masters of their universe. They have the best army and all the rest of it, to which I say, so why were there so many revolutions where they were pinned down for so many years and took casualties and all that if they were so invincible? And here's a case in point. So what appears to be is that the man in charge of the province, a man named Tinius Rufus, starts to get reports from his outposts. And the Roman army at this point consists of two legions and a lot of auxiliary troops, which is, say, professional non-Roman troops. And Jews basically grabbing the garrisons, killing them, and taking over the town. So Jericho and Engedi and places like this. And it's almost as if you were to have a map and do computer graphics, suddenly you'd find a little village would have flames would appear all over, right? And because of the way the communications work in those days, he's relying on messages to come back to his headquarters. And he's in Caesarea, which is a magnificent city on the West Coast. And if you ever go to Israel, you have to go to Caesarea because it's a wonderful place to go see. And what you have to understand is that that was not a Jewish city. That was a Roman Greek sort of Samaritan city, in the sense that if you were to walk down the streets of that place, it was like walking down a city in Italy or in Greece or Gaul, for example. I mean, regular streets, buildings you'd recognize, temples to Augustus, a functioning port with ships coming in from around the world. Just a busy working Roman city. But that's also where the governor, in this big, huge building, I mean, this thing is as big as a football field with two or three levels, military staff working in there, pumping in reports, allocating resources different places. And in AD 132, messages start arriving from the garrisons deployed across Judea, attacks underway, trying to deal with the situation, send help. And it seems to be for the first weeks or months, he goes, my guys on the ground, boots on the ground, will deal with this. The way the Roman army is set up, it's actually quite decentralized. There's a lot of authority quite low down in the ranking system. You know, it goes down to a centurion who is given operating instructions and can do a lot within those sorts of things. He doesn't need to be told, do I respond? He knows to respond, but also to keep the higher ups informed. And this is what's happening. And it's only after a while that Tinius Rufus pieces together, oh crap, I've got a revolt on my hands. He then seems to have just started to deploy his legion, which in this case is in Jerusalem. It's actually the 10th Fratensis, the Ironsides, which is quite an interesting kind of way of looking at it. And they're taking casualties. Why do we know they're taking casualties? Well, actually, there's a letter, interesting enough, Fronto, who is a correspondent, is writing to Hadrian's successor. I think it's actually Marcus Aurelius, so two down the line, where he makes this really interesting comment where he said, how many of us were killed by the Jews and by the Britons? And that's got two nuggets of information in there, which is to say, at the time of the Emperor Hadrian, there was a revolt not only in Judea, but also there was one in Britain, and they caused a lot of casualties. The Romans took lots and lots of casualties. So this was an embarrassment for them. And it's lost sort of in the other accounts. And this is why history is interesting, because you have to, like a bit like a detective, piece together all these things and sort of frame the narrative based on the clues and try and interpolate between the gaps, the lacunae. And what Tidius Rufus basically does, he calls on his its colleagues in the adjacent provinces, so Arabia Petraea, for example, and Syria, which is a bit north, where there are more legions. And again, the way that the Roman administration is set up, it's interesting to think about this. Again, we think about there being one monolithic Roman army. Turns out that's not true. They're provincialized. So there's the army of Britain, there is the army of Pannonia, there is the army of Syria. And the leaders of the commanders, the legates of those, report into the provincial governor, who is appointed by the emperor in person. So this man commands a great deal of authority directly given him by the emperor. But you know, it's actually when you look at coins minted by Hadrian himself, there are coins where it's like exercitum the Mauritania or somewhere, or Britain. And what he's doing, he's inspecting the troops of Britain, of Pannonia, of Mauritania, of Syria. And what that means is that if you're a governor in distress, I guess the way you do it, you send two instructions. You send a message to the emperor saying, update, chief, doing these things. What's your guidance? What are your instructions? But you can't wait because it's going to be 14, 15, 30 days before the message gets there. And holy hell could happen in between. So you have to use your initiative and you call on the guy next door and say, dear Caius, could you spare me a legion or two? And Caius will look at his call on his chiefs and say, you can have four cohorts. I'll take them, four cohorts on their way. And this is what happens. So in AD 132 going into 133, armies start moving in from the neighboring provinces, and they're called vexillations. And it's an interesting idea that the Romans have invented back probably in the days of Augustus, where you don't need to send a whole legion. You can send piece parts of it. A legion's made up of cohorts and 480 men in a cohort. And that's almost like a little self-functioning army. And they have the command structures and there are centuries within that. And you can break them off. Five. How many do you need? I can spare six. Right, which means that I don't have to give the person requiring it everything, but you can give them enough, but you can also fulfill responsibilities. So within about 2 or 3 years, upwards of 10 legions or vexillations thereof are operating within this teeny little piece of land that this rebel is calling Israel, which the Jews, they're holding out as their own country, and the Romans saying, that's our province, we want it back. And it's fascinating because you have to try to work out how on earth does that work when you've got maybe 30,000 troops coming from different parts of the empire, working on different command structures. And I'm almost thinking, I don't know if you know very much about the Revolutionary War in the United States, we're talking about 1776 and that period, how badly managed the British campaign was. Cornwallis and all these sorts of, Burgoyne and these sorts of people, I mean, they were pretty competent generals, but they didn't seem to know how to run a campaign together. and in part, the British lost North America, in part because of ineptitude, incompetence, not because of failures necessarily, the British soldiers on the ground to beat American Continental Army, but it was the ineptitude of the commanders to get their shit together, if I can say that online. And you get a similar sort of impression. That's what happens in Judea at this time. And what's fascinating is that Hadrian takes a very light touch to this, but you get a very interesting comment in Cassius Dio, where apparently a phrase that they would use, like an annual address to the Senate, who you had to keep on side, as it were, because they had to bless the legislation and sort of stuff. He would report back to them, since the army reported to him as the emperor, he was the commander-in-chief, CNC. And he basically said, I and the soldiers are well. But in this particular case, he doesn't use that expression, which is to say, there's a whole lot of shit happening and I'm trying to deal with it, but we're going to keep the lid on. And so that's an inference. If you combine that little nugget with the fronto thing I said earlier, the impression you get is of a situation crazy out of control, with lots of troops having to move in and a rebel who's running a campaign based on asymmetric guerrilla style warfare, with literally people appearing out of tunnels out of the ground, assaulting and ambushing Roman troops, and then as fast as they're disappearing. It's almost like the Viet Cong War of the Vietnam period. And I think that's probably the best analogy if I was to draw with a modern campaign. It was a bloody awful war in Vietnam, and it would appear to be in Judea at the time of Bar Kokhba, because he was using the advantages of an insurgent, surprise, local knowledge, and knowledge about how the opponent worked, But the Romans didn't know how the opponent worked. And they kept using their old tried and tested, and they just walked into ambushes all the time. It's extraordinary. So the Romans proved to be that they were not invincible for that time.
Yeah. And so I suppose them showing, as you say, that they're not this invincible great power, they do have their flaws. Does it mean that then Hadrian has to sort of now get involved and he can't leave a localized state anymore? He has to become involved, he has to send troops, and do they have any sort of effect at all?
There's a fascinating line, I think it's in Cassius Dio, when he basically says, "And then Hadrian sent him his best commander." And what's fascinating about this, so remember I mentioned in the letter Fronta that it was a rebellion in Britain? Mm. Well, it turns out the governor at that point was a guy called Julius Severus. And Julius Severus, we don't know much about him, frankly, but apparently he was able to put down a revolt in Britain. We have to imagine it was, it was pretty brutal, short and brief, high casualties and all that. But he'd impressed the emperor enough that he could fight a campaign in the hills and vales of Britannia. He could do the same thing in the hills and vales of Judea. Mm. So he literally sends this man, gather your troops, pick up what you need on the way, and he marches these thousands of miles, right? With actually, what's absolutely fascinating is if you go to Maryport on Hadrian's Wall and some other place like Chester, there are inscriptions which mention men who served in Judea. And the implication is that a contingent of British officers, auxiliaries and troops went with this governor, this Julius Severus, and went all the way down to Judea. And Judea is now basically taken over by this man in command. And then the command campaign changes. So what we seem to see again in Cassius Dio is this idea that instead of sending in a whole legion or cohort, what he does is, we're going to have to fight the guerrillas on their own terms. Mm. We know that they fight in their villages. So now instead of trying to draw them out into the open, because they're not going to come and fight us in the open, they know that's stupidity. So we're going to go and actually take them one by one by one by one, however long it takes, we'll just go one by one. And this is what he brings. And I have to imagine that this guy has probably been fighting against British rebels, like in the north of England, Yorkshire and places like that, in the north of Cumbria, what have you, and maybe even north of the wall that's being built, who knows, there's not enough information. And he uses those insights to start turning the tide in favor of the Romans. And then you would begin to get the impression, again, looking at the correspondence between Shimon ben Cosiba and his men, that the men on the ground seem to be completely believers to this. As far as they're concerned, they can kick back and they've got money coming in from tires and they've got all the sort of resources. And Shimon seems to understand it is not going well. And at one point, it seems to be that he's holed up in Herodium. Remember that conical tower that I mentioned outside of Jerusalem. Archaeological evidence points to there being a fire within this hill to explain there were tunnels in this hill. You get the impression that's how they fight with tunnels. And the tunnels were there very early on, partly because they were cisterns to hold rain. But during the First Jewish War, the rebels actually used this as to house troops. And when engineers under Ben Cosiba came along, what they did was actually expand the tunnels such that you could actually have four or five men shoulder, and they could actually march through. There were these trapdoors, and they could appear, and they could run down a hill and so on. There was a fire that the wood carbonized, and the fire was so intense that the stonework turned to chalk. And so we know there was this immense inferno, and in fact, Ben Cosiba seems to have escaped from there, at least some of his lieutenants did. And they were able to take their campaign into Engedi and other places further afield. But the turning point does seem to be that they appoint this British governor to bring in a new different way of fighting, and it does seem to work.
The really interesting thing is, because by even 135 CE, things haven't really changed, have they?
Well, it's hard to know, because unfortunately we don't have a Josephus. If people are familiar with the First Jewish War, we have that wonderful book, The Jewish War, Bellamy Dycombe, which literally is a minute-by-minute, town-by-town expose of what's happening. We don't have that for this war. So we have to rely on the few sources that we do have and archaeology. And what's really interesting is coins. I mentioned earlier what the rebels were doing. They would take Roman coins and they would literally smash, they would stamp on them new images. and that they would have the name of the head of state, Shimon, a Nazi Israel, but they also put year one of the redemption of Israel or redemption of Jerusalem. And we know that they get up to year three. And then there's what they're doing, they're dating their history from the first year of the revolution. So that sounds kind of very contemporary in a way, doesn't it? And the fact that these coins are going into circulation and people are very much engaged, because you can see the inference is that people with their money bags would bring in their silver coins and their copper coins or whatever. They'd probably go to a farm where Shmuel would actually have his die, and they'd say, come back tomorrow and we'll have all the new coins. They'd stamp them, and then suddenly the head of Hadrian on one day is replaced by a lyre or an image of the temple in Jerusalem. And that becomes the official currency. So we know there's one dimension to this, which is we know that this thing is going on for at least 3 years because they say so on the coins. But we also know from where those coins were found. So there are coin hoards, for example, that the collections of coins which have been found in caves or in different farm places are dotted around this area. So we can use that as a sort of an indicator of where that currency was accepted. And then by inference, you can say that's Jewish territory, if you will. But we also know, for example, that sometimes you find these coins fused together because they've been in intense heat. And again, that you can interpret from that, oh, if there was great heat and this is a farm, there must have been an attack and the place burned and these coins fused. And we know that there are several places in the Judean Shiflah where this was actually the case. And in fact, the archaeological evidence is pretty harrowing. I mean, there are skeletons found with, it's clear that decapitations took place because you could look at the vertebrae and you can say, oh, that's a clean cut there. And then they know that the bones were put in a mikvah, where they're basically putrefied because they can again see the deterioration of the bones. Yeah, it's a world in which brutality in war is accepted. There are no Geneva Conventions at this time, not for many centuries yet. And you can look at all these things and you can begin to see that what's happening is that this campaign with these deployed vexillations and a change in the way that they're actually deploying them into smaller groups, it is collapsing in on that really the rub of this area, which is finally around the area of the Dead Sea. And what's intriguing is, going back to the coin evidence, we have hardly any of those coins in Jerusalem. There's like four. They found the fourth one in May last year. And people would say, well, if there are coins found in Jerusalem, surely the Jews were actually occupying Jerusalem. Well, there's another way of looking at it. There are only four out of about 15,000, 16,000 that have been found. And the majority weren't found in Jerusalem. They may well have been that Roman legionaries picked them up. I'm keeping that as a souvenir. I was there, mission accomplished, put that in my money bag. Yeah. So what you're finding effectively is a war spoil of a victor. And the implication, my interpretation is that Jerusalem always remained out of grasp. The Romans had a fort there. They were never going to yield it. The optics of losing Jerusalem would have been pretty bad because this was Hadrian's new city, Ilia Capitolina. Gosh, you're not going to lose that. And where the Jewish insurgents were concentrated was south of that, and they seem to have been focused in on there. So in answering your question, I think it's really interesting when you apply numismatics, archaeology, epigraphy, and also just the written evidence in all these clever ways to infer. So you can't really do like a Second World War map where you show division number one goes here and at 6 o'clock it's over here. Unfortunately, you can't do that with ancient history. It's one of the great frustrations of being a military historian. But you can do the next best thing, which is to try and understand topography and ways of attacking and all these things. And you can say they would do this, not that. And the other thing is road network, right? I mean, the Roman legion is going to follow the roads. That's why they build them. So we sort of know the lines of attack. And what's very interesting is that Hadrian already invested in a major upgrade of the road network in that whole area. So he may have anticipated there were going to be problems in his way of that, just to make it easy for the troops to move around.
So finally, just to wrap up on what's been an absolutely fascinating topic, like I can't wait, I'm going to go and get this book, like a physical hard copy of this book for myself, because that book, yes, that you're waving around for is the wonderful, wonderful cover. What does become of Bar Kokhba? You know, how is he remembered? Is he like the last bastion of Jewish opposition to Rome?
Gosh, I think you must have read the sleeve notes. it's interesting. So there's a last stand, right? Everybody's heard of Masada, but very few people have heard of Betar. Mm. Bitar was Bar Kokhba's last stand. And this is a little town on a hilltop just south of Jerusalem in the beautiful area of the Judean Hills, which are achingly beautiful. They're covered with trees and they're little hills, which are very, very compressed, and they're little ravines. And there was a town beside a road, and that's where he decided to bring his moment of closure to this whole thing. And it does appear to be, and again, it's interesting, the rabbinic texts talk about hundreds of synagogues being set up in this place. So what I have to imagine is this little tiny little town on the top of a hill, which only had like a population of 1,000 people, and they were fairly affluent people. The buildings, the archaeology show, were quite nice buildings. And then it's very interesting, a wall is built, a gerrymandered wall gets thrown up around this thing. Buildings get demolished and they reuse the stones so they can actually build this wall. And what they seem to do is hold themselves up, expecting a big siege. They knew about sieges because the Romans had done this to Jerusalem back in 70, so they kind of were forewarned about this. And there are little caches of things like sling stones that they found, which are great because that would infer they're building up magazines of armaments, if you like, ammunition ready to attack. And it's where those are is interesting because they're expecting an attack on the east side, but actually maybe that's a mistake because it's a steep incline on the other side. Do you think that's going to bother the Romans much? So what happens is that there are all these people pile in there, and you have to imagine this becomes a shanty town. So in this, there are hundreds of synagogues and people doing these things to try and survive. It is a very evocative way, I think, of, you know, you can imagine like a refugees all piled into this tiny old place. Water supplies are running out, food is bad, hygiene, you can imagine the awfulness of it. And then their own army sends vexillations down there. They've had a tip off, or their intelligence is good enough. They build a circulation wall, a circumvallation, I'm sorry, around this place. How do we know about this? Well, it's fascinating. I bought a book. We have a bookshop here called Half Price Books. And I found a book, as it turns out, that was about aerial archaeology. And it was published like in the 80s or something, and it's all black and white. And I flipped through this book, and I was amazed. There was an aerial photograph from about 1927, like the bridge had flown over. And they'd taken a photograph where there's hardly anything there, no people were living at this point. And you can see the outlines of this thing. It had been there since AD 135. It's not there now because people live there now, and they use the stones to build their sheds and, you know, farms and walls around the farm. And again, this is how you have to interpret it. And what's very clear is the Romans took the attack and they sealed off the town. They built camps. And what's fascinating is that they looked at it and said, okay, hill there, we're going to build our forts here. We can then fire an enfilade around there. And what's even more amazing is that they literally had decided this was going to be the showdown. So they built two camps right above Bitar, overlooking it. And then in a ring of forts going off in a curve off even further south. So it's like that they were saying, he ain't going nowhere, this guy. You know, we just have so many resources at this point at our disposal. And again, there's nothing in the Roman texts which tell us the day, whatever, or even what happened. But what we do have in the Jewish texts is this echo of blood in the streets, kids' brains being dashed on stones and this sort of thing. And there were so many spikes stabbed into people's hearts that the streets ran with blood, and, you know, the hills were red and so on. So it seems to be that he died there. We don't know. Again, the Jewish sort of sources are very interesting. They try to sort of like accommodate for Hadrian as being a man that didn't realize who he was dealing with. And if only he'd realized how really important Bar Kokhba was, he would have understood him to be a better man. And he would have, you know, they portray Hadrian in the sense of being, if only I'd known. And so we seem to think that around about 135, Bitar finally falls, and that's the end of the revolt. Except that a few miles away, down this long road that is around the Dead Sea, there's a little tiny little town called En Gedi. And what's fascinating, En Gedi was a little industrial town. We now think of it as being a sort of seaside town. Back in Bar Kokhba's day, this was a thriving little port. They were making scents, this balsam, which was the most expensive thing to buy in the world at that time. But, you know, they had certain trees which had resin, and they'd put perfumes and things in the resin. They'd ship them out from there. You know, bitumen, asphalt, it used to pop up from the lake in great big bobs. And the people go out in their little reed boats, and they come and collect it, and they package it up and ship it to the shipyards. And Roman ships with bitumen and pitch to seal the gaps between the planks, they would use En Gedi bitumen. And there was a Roman garrison there. So this has been taken over, and we know a lot about this little place because a letter survived of a lady, of all things. She was a lady that had moved from Arabia. She divorced her husband, was doing various things to try and make sure she got the money to pay for her future and for her kids and so on. And we also have letters where people are buying land and renting buildings and all sorts of stuff. And then it suddenly abruptly stops. And the reason is because with the fall of Batar, the Roman troops hunt these people down, and those people flee to the caves up in the valley behind. That the stark beauty of that area is in its sort of desert-like magnificence. They have these canyons on the western side, which go several hundred meters inland, and there's a little tiny little stream that comes at the bottom of some of them. But there are, in this 1,000-foot drop between the top of the hill and the bottom, are caves. And these refugees scrambled up to these caves, hoping that they would be able to see out the wall. And what is very clear is they were not successful. And this is the very moving part of the story, because you go back to Yigal Yadin, who is the archaeologist back in the 50s, 60s, and even now they're still doing excavations where they have found bones and personal belongings like pans and baskets. I mean, literally woven baskets with rope on, and combs and bundles of letters tied together with threads of string, keys for front doors. I mean, you have to imagine that these are middle class people who've thrown in their lot with the revolt. Right? They think they're going to win. I believe in this guy, and then they're now forced to live in a cave. I mean, they've given up the household comforts, creature comforts, for a horrible, dry, uncomfortable place to live, and they starve to death. And the Romans play on this. So all they do is that they build camps on the top of the ledge, and anytime someone pops their head out, they fire an arrow to keep them. And then there's a certain point, no more heads appear. And the Romans make a determination, I think it's done. 6 months later, they move on. This is the other side of the story. It's a very brutal, intensely human story. And the extraordinary thing is that nearly 2,000 years later, interesting enough, on the Bar Mitzvah of the State of Israel, these things come to light. And what's extraordinary is that there's an apocryphal story where these letters of Bar Kokhba are found, where he is writing to his lieutenants. And Yigal Yadin is basically an archaeologist that used to be a commander. And they sort of say, these are messages from the previous prime minister of Israel. And the reason why it is spooky, because why do we discover them now, right? So a lot of people feel that there's this kind of interesting spiritual connection that goes with that. But the archaeology is very, very clear that the revolution ended there. People died there. If you go to that part of the world now, there is right on the top, there's a monument where some of the bones were reburied. They thought it was the thing to do. And there's an inscription on there. Unfortunately, that's the one they got now there, I think, is about the third one, because they always seem to get damaged and vandalized. So it feeds into this really interesting thing that a lot of people are not happy that there is a state of Israel. And these historical events are the subject themselves of attack. And so to kind of wrap up our discussion, what happened after was that the Jews did a lot of soul searching. They wanted to know was, how could we be so duped? How could this thing go so wrong? If this guy is the Messiah, why are we in this position? And they start writing the texts. And what's fascinating about Judaism as a culture, it is about study and learning and gaining insights. And they write in things like Mishnah, a Midrash, which are documents which try to interpret the religious texts and inform it with contemporary events so that they can say, this is how we will live today under these circumstances, hearkening back to what Solomon did or something like that, because the verses say this. And they write in these comments that are basically that we were duped. This man wasn't son of a star, he was son of a lie. We were conned. And this is how they look at this. There's this great sense of loss and mourning. It ties in also with the immediate Roman response, which was having obliterated the Jewish revolt and reestablished control. And by the way, Hadrian got his city, that Aelia Capitolina was built. They did build another temple on the Temple Mount. There still isn't one there, now it's over the rock. The whole plan of the modern Jerusalem that we see today still has echoes of Hadrian's city in it. The street plan has echoes of it in there. The Jews were banned from entering Jerusalem. Can you imagine that? I mean, this is your sacred city, you're not allowed to go there. And there was a sense that there was a expulsion of the rebel communities, and a lot of them found themselves in other countries as slaves, effectively. So that's a moving piece. So a lot of people say that the reason for a Jewish diaspora can be drawn back, the lines go back to this revolt, which is partly true. That the interesting thing is that it was only that part of Judea that was impacted. If you were a Jew living in Samaria or further north, business as usual. So there was some soul searching back in the 80s, 90s, where people said, how could we as Jewish people, and just that I'm not myself Jewish, how could we as people ourselves end up by making a hero out of a failed leader? Because by the time you get to the 19th century, a sort of Robin Hoodization or a King Arthurization of this man, he'd become a folk hero. And people say, well, how can you turn a loser into a winner? And the context is this, and it's very interesting that you're going to Poland, because Poland was one of the epicenters of anti-Semitism and pogroms in the 30s, the 1930s, is the fact that they said, you know what, we as Jewish people, we've always been picked on. We're always being kicked in the guts and shouted at and spat at and so on. We have our own heroes too. And the way that the diaspora Jews looked at it, they looked back at the history and said, there was one man who 1,000 years ago stood up to the Romans and took his country back. And there was, in this sort of rise of Zionism, one particular individual who coined the idea of muscular Judaism. Instead of being this feeble, weak person, he said, we're as strong as anybody. And so they started engaging athletics and football and all sorts of stuff. And they were Bar Kokhba sports clubs set up all across the east of Europe. And you'll find evidence of them in Poland and Lithuania and Latvia, Hungary, Poland, all over Germany. And this is in the 1910s, 1920s, 1930s. And there's more and more of a case being made for a state of Israel. And you remember the Balfour Declaration, 1917? That's part of the sort of narrative that's going on here. And it culminates ultimately where in the death camps where people meet horrible ends, when that's all exposed in sort of 1945, and the United Nations then says, yes, there will be a state for Jewry, it's going to be the state of Israel. By now, you have these resistance groups who are fighting in the name of Bar Kokhba. Menachem Begin and people like that, who were, and Yigal Yadin, who have become modern political figures in Jewish history, Israeli history. We're drawing on the iconography and the reputations of fallen heroes to rally their soldiers, to beat the British, to beat the Arabs, to take their country back. And all this came to a head, really, with the discovery of the documents in the 1950s and 60s in those caves. A lot of political capital was made out of that. He occasionally appears on stamps and on coins. There are operas about him. There are plays about him. There are novels about him. They're all written in Hebrew. So for people who don't speak any Ivrit or Hebrew, it's not accessible. And part of the reason I told this story was, I thought it was a wonderful story because it's an ancient story that informs a modern country and its narrative and its history. And I'm hoping to bring it to a modern audience because I think it's one that needs to be heard.
It's been so enlightening having you here. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us. And Lindsay, thank you for joining us as well.
Oh, my pleasure. Bavakasha.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/historyhack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.